Did everyone get to smell this last time? You shouldn't miss your opportunity to smell this. Everyone smelled the oil of bitter almonds? Okay, you're going to be our custodian for a while, okay? Check it out. Let's see. Okay, so we're looking at the 18, roughly 1830 to 1855 today, at the way experiments caused the development of the theory of organic chemistry, and in particular, the structural theory. So in 1832 came the radical theory, and it was. We saw last time how this happened, that Wöhler and Liebig had become great friends, were collaborating. Wöhler's wife died, so he went to stay with Liebig for a few weeks to work together to try to get over his grief. He wrote in 12th of July to Liebig, "The oil of bitter almonds has come with the books from Paris. I've kept half of it, herewith sending you the rest. I've already started all kinds of experiments with it without being able to obtain any precise results." It seems to be a hard nut. He was the kind of guy that can't resist a pun, right? "I'm coming soon to you and we'll be able to report." So by August, he was back home again and wrote again to Liebig, "Here I am again in my gloomy lonesomeness without knowing how to thank you for all the love with which you took me in and kept me for so long. How happy I was to work with you from moment to moment. Herewith, I'm sending the paper on the oil of bitter almonds." So what would they do with the oil of bitter almonds? What's the first thing anybody would do in those days? This was a new substance that had just recently been obtained by steam distillation from bitter almonds. It's also in peach pits and things like that. So what would they do first when they have a pure substance? They want to know something about it. Pardon me? Can't hear very well. The elemental analysis, right? That's what Liebig was famous for. Okay, and then they'd do reactions, and they'd get new products. And what would they do then, when they get a new pure product? Wells? So they do a reaction with the oil of bitter almonds. They get a new product. What do they do?
Elemental analysis.
Right. Okay, so here's the oil of bitter almonds. Now you've looked at it. What did you notice about it? First, its smell is like marzipan or something, like almonds, right? What else did you notice about it? How observant were you? Where is it? Ah, there. Here's your chance, Leong, to shine as an observant chemist. Don't open it. But what do you observe about it? Look at it carefully. Turn it over. Turn it upside down. It's half full of solid. Anybody notice that? Liebig and Wöhler did. Okay. But the oil is a liquid. That's why it's called an oil. So what's the solid? So what did they do, Wells?
Did they run elemental analysis on it?
Right. So they had the oil of bitter almonds, and they found out it was C7H6O. Of course, it would depend. What they got would depend on what they thought the atomic weights were. Some of them were off by a factor of two, as we've seen. But anyhow, that's what we got. What they got expressed in our terms, C7H6O. Okay, and then they reacted it with oxygen. Right? What is this? When was that bottle opened? Alex, it says on it. On the label. Written on the label. By hand.
11/29/95.
So it was opened 15 years ago, right? And in the meantime, oxygen has gotten in and reacted with the oil of bitter almonds. Okay, so then they got C7H6O. And then they reacted it with bromine. And what did they do, Wells? And they got C7H5OBr. And then they reacted it with Cl2. Wells? Potassium iodide, ammonia, lead sulfide, and all the time they analyzed it, right? So they got all these, okay? Now, is this just something to do, or can you conclude anything from this? This turned out to be the basis of an entirely new theory of organic chemistry. These results. So they got these six new compounds plus the oil of bitter almonds, and they have their analyses. So what? What do you observe from this, or what did they observe? Yeah. Aha. They all have C7H5O plus some other element, right? In the first case, it was an H. In the second case, it was another O, or Cl, or Br, or I, or N. How about the last one on the bottom right? Does that have C7H5O? It's got two of them, right, together with a sulfur. Right? So this group of atoms persists through reactions, the same way an element persists through reactions. Right? So they had the idea that this thing was a radical, a root, a fundamental group, C7H5O, and they called it the benzoyl radical. The eel suffix means the matter of, or the basis of. Right? So this was the basis of benzoic acid, which is the stuff at the top there, or benzaldehyde, which is the oil of bitter almonds. So they reported this in 1832 and showed that they had BZH, BZOH, BZCl, BZBr, BZI, and so on. Okay? So a radical can be the base of more than just an acid. It can be the base of lots of things here, as we've seen, of iodides, chlorides, amines, and so on. So the benzoyl radical gave rise to the theory called organic dualism. We already saw dualism, the idea that plus holds on to minus, right? But here's the idea as extended to organic chemistry. You can have organic elements composed of many fundamental elements, which themselves can hold together with to something like chlorine by a kind of dualism. So this extended the theory that was that applied to inorganic chemistry to organic chemistry. Okay, so during the 1830s, these so-called compound radicals, because there were many elements in them, were discovered everywhere. So Liebig in Germany got acetyl, and Bunsen in Germany got cacodyl, dimethyl arsenic radical. Okay, in Sweden, Berzelius got ethyl. Pyrea in Italy got salicyl. And Dumas, a hard worker in France, got methyl and cetyl and cinnamyl and ethylene. So they found all these radicals of organic compounds that they could then use to explain, to organize organic chemistry. And in fact, this theory survives today. And where it survives is in our nomenclature. Because we have, for example, the compound ethyl chloride. It's two words, right? Ethyl chloride. And those are a positive and a negative thing holding together. Ethyl plus, chloride minus are held together in this theory, a dualistic theory. Okay? And the eel, as I said, comes from ele, which means in Greek means either wood or matter. So it's the matter of something. Now, ethyl, it's the matter of what? Now, ether comes from etho, which means to shine, and then it was associated with the sky because the sky was clear and shining, and then with any colorless liquid was called an ether. But a particular ether was what we now call diethyl ether that was made by treating ethanol with sulfuric acid. So this ethyl is the element from which diethyl ether is made in this theory. Okay? So ethyl, and Liebig devised that name in 1834 on the basis of this theory. How about methyl? So meth comes from methy, which means wine or spirit, okay? And eel, which means wood or matter. But in this case, instead of meaning matter, it means wood. And ene is from ene, which is the Greek feminine patronymic. It means the daughter of, like Persephone is the daughter of somebody, or Antigone, and so all those E-N-E-Ns or O-N-E's mean the daughter of somebody or other. So methylene, it was the daughter of wood spirits. So what's wood spirits? Amy? I can't hear very well. No, that's almond was different. That's mandel is the word for almond. So mandelic acid is from almonds, for example. But what's wood spirit? Yeah. It's an alcohol you get from wood. Did you ever hear of wood alcohol? What is it? Do you know?
Methanol,
right? So the daughter of wood spirits is this fundamental bit of wood spirit. So wood spirit is methanol, and that comes from this radical reacting with water, according to this theory. So the daughter of wood spirits was methylene. So this, CH2, was methylene. Okay? And then in 1840, the word methyl was created from methylene to mean CH3. Right? And in 1852, ethylene was created. It was created by analogy, because they already had ethyl, as we talked about last time. They had methylene and methyl. So ethylene was to ethyl as methylene was to methyl. So that's where the name ethylene came from. So this is the period that a lot of the names we deal with originated. And they originated according to this theory. So how about C3 and C4? Do you know what they're called? C3? What's the name of a C3 group? Anybody know? Or C4? Propane is C3. C4, anybody?
Butane.
Okay, so where do those names come from? So C3H7 is propyl, and C3H6 is propylene or propene. Okay, and C4 is butyl or butylene or butene. Right? So the C4 comes from butyric acid, which comes from the Latin word for butter, because it was isolated from rancid butter, butyric acid. It makes it smell bad. Okay? The propyl is even more interesting. It comes from propionic acid. So protos means first, and peon means fat. So there were these series of acids isolated from fats, right, with more and more carbons in them. When they get pretty long chain, they don't mix with water. But the very shortest ones mix with water. Formic acid, acetic acid, mix with water. But propionic acid doesn't mix with water in all ratios. It's the first really fatty acid that doesn't mix with water. So what it means is the first fat, propion. Okay? So that's where those names come from. Now, Jean-Baptiste André Dumas, not the guy who wrote The Man in the Iron Mask and The Count of Monte Cristo, right, was born, notice, on Bastille Day. So he was a real protector of the French tradition in chemistry, which the French were very proud of their chemistry properly because of Lavoisier. But the momentum was being transferred to these guys in Germany. So Dumas stood for the French tradition in chemistry. He was a chaired professor. In fact, he had the chair in three different institutions in Paris simultaneously. This was a very counterproductive practice the French had, to appoint some star to be the professor not only at Yale, but also at Harvard, also at Columbia, also at Penn, also at Cornell, and so on. So it focused too much of the attention on one person, and it wasn't possible for other people to make the contributions they otherwise would do. So anyhow, he was a big wheel. And he was a persistent opponent of Liebig and Berzelius, who were the representatives of the Teutonic tradition in chemistry rather than the French. Okay? But in 1837, he wrote a paper together, ostensibly, with Liebig. In fact, Liebig had had nothing to do with it. They had been at one another's throats, and Dumas got the impression that they finally agreed. He'd been able to convince Liebig of something. So he wrote this paper with both of them as authors about how much they agreed, but Liebig never really signed on to it. Anyhow, this is the note on the present state of organic chemistry. 60 years have hardly passed since that ever memorable time when this same assembly heard the first discussions of the fertile chemical doctrine, which we owe to the genius of Lavoisier. This short span of time has sufficed to examine fully the most delicate questions of inorganic chemistry, and anyone can easily convince himself that this branch of our knowledge possesses almost everything that it can with the methods of observation available. So forget inorganic chemistry. We've got that one done. Okay. This myopia is everywhere. Remember Lavoisier had it too. There barely remain a few cracks here and there to fill in. Okay. In a word, so this is a word, this sentence. How, with the help of the laws of inorganic chemistry, can one explain and classify such varied substances as one obtains from organic bodies, which nearly always are formed only of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, to which elements nitrogen is sometimes joined? How can you get so many different substances that have the same analysis or made of the same elements? Okay, so he liked to hear himself talk. This was the great and beautiful question of natural philosophy. A question well designed to excite the highest degree of competition among chemists. For once resolved, the most beautiful triumphs were promised to science. The mysteries of plants, the mysteries of animal life would be unveiled before our eyes. We would seize the key to all the changes of matter, so sudden, so swift, so singular, that occur in animals and plants. More importantly, we would find the means of duplicating them in our laboratories. So it's as good as sequencing the human genome, right? Then everything is solved. Okay? Well, we are not afraid to say it. And it is not an assertion which we make lightly. This great and beautiful question is today answered. Okay? It only remains to follow through on all the consequences which its solution entails. Okay? In fact, to produce with three or four elements such varied combinations, more varied perhaps than those which make up the whole inorganic kingdom, nature has chosen a path as simple as it was unexpected. For with elements, she has made compounds which behave in all their properties like elements themselves. That is, you have these compound radicals like acetyl, ethyl, methyl, and so on. And this, we are convinced, is the entire secret of organic chemistry. Thus, organic chemistry possesses its own elements, which sometimes play the role of chlorine or oxygen in inorganic chemistry. Sometimes, on the contrary, play the role of metals. What does he mean, play the role of chlorine or oxygen, as opposed to play the role of metals? What was the theory? Yeah. Can't hear very well. Not acids or bases. No, it's not a bad idea, but that's not what he was thinking of. Yeah, what else? Yeah, some are positive and some are negative. So now you can apply dualism to organic chemistry. Okay? Cyanogen, amide, benzoyl, the radicals of ammonia, of aliphatics, of alcohol, analogous substances, these are the true elements with which inorganic, with which organic chemistry operates. To discover these radicals, to study them, to characterize them, this has been our daily study for 10 years. Sometimes, nonetheless, our opinions have appeared to differ between Dumas and Liebig. And then, with each of us drawn on by the heat of our battle with nature, there arose between us discussions whose liveliness we both regret. Actually, when we were able to discuss questions which separated us in several friendly meetings, we soon realized that we were in agreement on the principles. We then understood that united we could undertake a task before which either of us in isolation would have recoiled. We will analyze every organic substance. See, Wells? We will analyze every organic substance to establish reliably what sort of radical it refers to. Okay. Each of us has, in fact, opened his laboratory to all young men who were motivated by true love of science. That's true love of science, right? That is what we do. Okay? They have seen all, understood all. We have worked under their eyes and have had them work under ours in such a way that we are surrounded by young rivals who are the hope of science and whose work will be added to ours and mingle with ours. For it will have been conceived in the same spirit and carried out by the same methods. So here's this guy who's the professor at all the universities in Paris who hopes to get everyone in all Europe to do exactly the same thing he's doing because it's the right thing to do. Right? This is not an effort conceived for personal gain or in the interest of narrow vanity. No, and in a collaboration which is perhaps unheard of in the history of science, this is an undertaking in which we hope to interest every chemist in Europe. So if you can get everybody to work on the same thing, on what I want to do, then you've got it, right? Now, there were some problems with dualism, despite Dumas' enthusiasm here. For example, the preparation of benzoyl chloride, which resulted from reacting the oil of bitter almonds with chlorine. Okay, so look at the products. You have HCl, okay, that's plus minus, and you have benzoyl chloride, which is plus minus. What's funny in this thing? Sebastian?
It has to be plus plus.
Aha, uh-huh, that's plus plus. There seem to be some problems with the theory. Okay. So in the late 1830s and through to the 1850s, the French developed a new theory to compete with the fundamentally German dualistic theory, which was sometimes called the substitution theory, sometimes the type theory, and sometimes the unitary theory to distinguish it from the dualistic theory. And it started in at the Tuileries Palace in about 1830 when there was a big ball. And when they lit the candles, suddenly everybody began coughing and choking, right? And they found out that the culprit was HCl that had been generated from the wax in the candles, which had been bleached and made beautifully white by treating it with chlorine. Okay? So this implied to Dumas that organic compounds can somehow fix chlorine gas. They can trap chlorine gas somehow in a way that then when you burn the candles, it can be released. So how did this happen? Well, we could look from our current perspective of HOMOs, LUMOs, and SOMOs to see how an organic compound might react with chlorine. So what makes chlorine reactive, Cl2? What's its unusual orbital? What's the high HOMO? Aisha? Unshared, there certainly are unshared pairs on the chlorine. Are they unusually high, say, compared with unshared pairs on nitrogen, for example? No, chlorine's way off on the end of the periodic table. So there are high HOMOs, but they're not very high. Okay? What would the unusually low LUMO be? Sigma star Cl. Why? Because the Cls have a big nuclear charge, right? So even if they and big atoms don't overlap as well as little atoms at their bonding distance because there's more repulsion of filled orbitals with filled orbitals, so they stand off, and therefore they don't have as good overlap. Okay, so you don't have such good overlap, and you start low with chlorine, so you have a low LUMO on chlorine. Now, let's take a compound like ethylene, which was called the olefiant gas. That means the gas that makes an oil. Okay, what makes it reactive? Poi? Is it pi star? Is that what you're looking for to react with sigma star? It does have pi star, and pi star is unusually low. Yeah. The pi is even more unusually high. So sometimes pi star is the thing, if you're looking for something to react with something that's a very high orbital. But we're looking for something to react with chlorine, right? So pi is going to be the job. Okay, so let's look at it. We can shift those electrons in and those out, make a bond and break a bond, and we would get this. And chloride would leave. Okay, so we've made a new bond. But here we have reactivity as well. What reactivity does this thing have? Where's an unusual orbital there?
Electric charge.
So what does the charge do? No, in principle, this positive could react with the negative you got here. But something else happens first. Don't say it's positive. Tell me what orbital it has. It's positive, right? And the carbon is making three bonds. So what does it have in terms of a low LUMO? A p orbital, right? And it's unusually low because... So there's a low LUMO here. Are there any high HOMOs around? Well, someplace there's a chloride, right? But is there something even closer? Aisha?
Hydrogen.
Now we have a really, really low LUMO here with a positive charge. So now we don't need such a very high HOMO. What do we have? Unshared pairs, right? Okay, so we can do that. Okay, now the positive charge is written on chlorine. But actually, both those steps happen at once. You make two bonds at the same time. Right? And we can see that by looking at the orbitals that are involved. So here's the LUMO, sigma star of ClCl, and here's the HOMO, pi. Right? So they overlap. The electrons that are in here mix with here. Okay, and get stabilized. So you get bonding in here, involving three atoms, carbon, carbon, and chlorine. Okay? But at the same time, we have a HOMO here and a LUMO here. The LUMO on the right is Po Yee's, right, the pi star. The HOMO here is unshared pair, actually a combination of two unshared pairs. Right? So these overlap, and you can get these electrons being stabilized by this vacant orbital. So you get bonding between the chlorine and this carbon, bonding between the chlorine and this carbon. So you have now two electron pairs, right? Both of them involved in bonding between this chlorine and this chlorine and this carbon. So you have two bonds. Okay, so both those things happen at once as the chlorine comes in, and then this chloride goes away. Okay, so we've got that thing now. Now, what makes this reactive? You think it would be a high HOMO or a low LUMO? Just to guess. Natalie, what do you think? Why? Right, you got electric charge and a very electronegative atom. So can you name an orbital in this that's likely to be a low LUMO? Right, sigma star, carbon-chlorine. Okay? So here's a picture of sigma star carbon-chlorine, right? And now what do we have that can attack it, a high HOMO? The chlorine minus that we generated here. So if we send it over there, right, then its unshared pair can come in and attack, right, and break that bond. You make a bond, break a bond, the way we always do. And now we have this. So this is the product that Yeet wanted to get, but there's that intermediate, that three-membered ring that was formed because the unshared pair on the chlorine in the same molecule was much closer and ready to do it, where this was off in left field someplace. It took a while to come around and attack. Okay, and that stuff was discovered actually. So this is addition of chlorine to an alkene, right? You add the elements of chlorine, two Cls, to the alkene by this HOMO-LUMO thing. And in fact, I may have skipped over it. This stuff here was called the oil of Dutch chemists, because in 1795, some Dutch chemists had prepared that, and that's why this stuff was called the oil-making gas, the oil-olefiant gas, because it was already known that it reacted with chlorine to give that. Okay, now, there's another way they can react, because the chlorine-chlorine bond, notice that if you're reacting with just a regular old alkane, like methane, there's no high HOMO and no low LUMO by definition. These are the standard HOMOs and LUMOs involved in that molecule. Okay, so but you can do something else. Because this bond is unusually weak, because as we are saying, chlorines don't overlap very well with one another. So that bond is only about half as strong as most bonds we deal with, carbon-carbon, carbon-oxygen. Right? But it's still enough that it holds together well. It's hard to break. So you have to get extra energy in order to break that bond. And the reason that I've coded here how you do it. I made this green. Why? Did anyone ever see chlorine gas? It's green. It absorbs light, right? So it'll absorb from light a quantum of energy, which takes an electron that's in sigma and puts it in sigma star, right? Those are close enough together that visible light can do it. So you see light get absorbed by chlorine. Now, when you get an electron in sigma star, then the bond breaks, right? Because you got one electron in sigma, one in sigma star. They cancel each other. The chlorines come apart, right? But they come apart as atoms. So what we've drawn here is not what we usually draw. Like here, a regular regular arrow with two prongs on it. We draw just one prong to mean it's just one electron. Right? So one electron from this bond goes here, one goes here, and you get two chlorine atoms. So single barbed arrows. Okay? So now you have a chlorine atom, a SOMO. Right? So this is different. This was HOMO LUMO up here. But now we've got singly occupied orbital. So this electron can pair with one of the electrons in this bond. This SOMO can react. And again, you make a bond here and break a bond here. But you made a bond and broke a bond here. But this is different because you're moving single electrons. Okay, so you get HCl, that's the product that choked people, and the methyl radical, right? But now that's a SOMO too, right? So it can react with two Cls and give methyl chloride and a Cl atom. Now what's neat about this whole process? Can you see what's special? What started it going? Getting a chlorine atom. What's the product? A chlorine atom. So what's going to happen? Do you see? It'll do it again, right? It'll come back and start over again. So what's called a free radical chain reaction. It keeps happening again and again. Once you put light in once in order to make these things, then they react over and over and over again. Okay, so you get lots of product from one initial photolysis. So this is two ways that wax could fix chlorine. If it had double bonds in the wax, which it would, then you can add. But also it's possible to get substitution of chlorine for hydrogen. So this meant that there was more trouble for the radical theory. This Dumas in 1839, just 2 years after he wrote this panegyric about how wonderful his agreement with Liebig was, 2 years later, he studies the photochlorination of acetic acid. So acetic acid has the acetyl radical and OH, right? Dualism, right? But by reacting it with chlorine and light, he could replace a hydrogen by chlorine. Instead of C2H3, it's C2H2Cl, right? And in fact, you could do it again. And you could do it again to get trichloroacetic acid, right? So if this was an element, right, as the dualistic theory supposed, that the radicals behave like elements, then this is changing an element from one element to another. It's transmuting an element, right, which wasn't a popular thing. Okay, so that seems troublesome for the radical theory. Okay, so hydrogen may be substituted by an equivalent amount of halogen, that's one for one, oxygen, one oxygen would replace two chlorines, or two hydrogens, and so on. But all these acids were acids, right? They were all tart and so on. In fact, trichloroacetic acid is a very strong acid. So you maintained the same type of molecule as you did this substitution of one atom for another, right? So the type survived during these transmutations. So you didn't change the molecular type. Now, in 1853, four fundamental types were recognized: water, hydrogen, hydrochloric acid, and ammonia. So here's the notation that was used to show it. So this is the water type. It's oxygen associated with two hydrogens. Hydrochloric acid is H and Cl together, two hydrogens of the hydrogen type, and nitrogen with three hydrogens of the ammonia type. But now you could replace these things one by another, the substitution theory, right? So for example, you could have ethylamine or diethylamine or triethylamine. Or over here you could have, instead of water, you could have ethyl alcohol replacing the H by the ethyl group. Or you could have the salt of ethyl alcohol, the potassium salt. Or of the HCl type, you could replace the H by Ca2H5 and the chlorine by iodine, so you could get that. And it was known, it was discovered in the 1850s that these two will react with one another, right? To give this, where the ethyl comes here and the potassium goes there, right? And that's called that reaction is called the Williamson ether synthesis from 1850, right? So Alexander William Williamson in England discovered this and used this theory to explain it. In fact, he suggested drawing these things as things that can rotate and exchange each other. This is very interesting. Dumas, up till this time, remember, Dalton had drawn pictures of molecules, you know, a symbol with three symbols around it or something like that. But Berzelius had nothing like that. He just wrote what element and how many, what element and how many atoms of that, right? But now they were back to drawing pictures of molecules again. So Dumas said, molecules are like planetary systems held together by a force resembling gravitation, but acting in accord with much more complicated laws. Right? And the idea was you could replace one planet by the other, have by another one from some other solar system, and have a system that's fundamentally sort of the same type, but a different molecule, replacing, substituting one thing for another. Or Williamson, who was only 27 years old in 1851, said, formulae may be used as an actual image of what we rationally suppose to be the arrangement of constituent atoms in a compound, as an orrery is an image of what we conclude to be the arrangement of our planetary system. Do you know what an orrery is? Anybody know? This is a picture of an orrery. Have you ever seen one of these? It's a mechanical model of the solar system, and it's all connected with chains and gears, and the moons all go around Jupiter at the right time and the period and so on. So that's a very complicated thing. But that's what he thought that the arrangement of atoms was like. It's like a solar system. Who knows what complicated laws hold it together, but you can substitute one for another. Okay? So this is a unitary theory. It's the solar system structure that's fundamental, not which things are in it. So it's not no longer plus minus holding it together. It's some complicated force, perhaps resembling gravitation. Okay, now, notice, remember, butyl bromide is two words. That's a relic of radical dualism theory. But there's another name for butyl bromide. Does anybody know what it is? What else you can call it? You can also call it bromobutane, which says it's butane modified by a substitution, right? And you write that as one word because it's the unitary theory. Right, it's this thing, all one substance, but you can do substitutions on it. So these two different, we survive with two different ways of naming these simple compounds, because one of them came from dualistic theory and the other came from this type or unitary theory. Okay, so Berzelius in 1838 wasn't about to stand still for this. He said, by reacting chlorine with ordinary ether, Dumas produced a very interesting compound, which he reckoned, according to the theory of substitutions, to be an ether in which four atoms of chlorine replace four atoms of hydrogen. An element as eminently electronegative as chlorine would never be able to enter into an organic radical. Right? The organic is plus, chlorine's minus. This idea is contrary to the first principles of chemistry, namely my principles of chemistry, right? Dualism. Okay. Incidentally, just as a footnote, in that same paper, he had this, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but he drew this here, and that's the first place that the use of that the word R was used to denote a radical, and we still use that today, right? R. X or something like that. It comes from Berzelius in 1838. Now, this was the period in which the first chemical journals, there were science journals before that, but no strictly chemical journals, but the Annalen of Chemistry and Pharmacy was begun at this time and taken over by this new editorial team. You see, there's Dumas in Paris, Graham in London, Wöhler in Germany, and especially Liebig. He was the guy that really did it. It says edited by Wöhler and Liebig, but Liebig did all the work, and with collaboration of Dumas and Graham. Now, in fact, this is, notice, 1840 by the time that Dumas and Liebig have definitely fallen out with one another. But, and this journal became known as Liebig's Annalen. There was no question whose it was. Okay, so here in 1840, there's the first paper in this issue was on the law of substitutions and the theory of types. Notice it's by Dumas, but it's written in German, right? Because it's a German publication. And the point number one is, can one in any compound substitute the elements equivalent for equivalent by simpler compound bodies that play their role? That's the substitution theory we've been talking about. And his answer is a definitive yes, although you won't be surprised to hear in many pages. Okay. Now, the very next paper is remarks on the previous paper, and this is by J.L., the editor, Justus Liebig. And he says, "I am a far cry from sharing the ideas that Monsieur Dumas has linked to the so-called laws of the substitution theory." But this was really the hot stuff. So the very next paper is, as you see, on the substitution law of Monsieur Dumas by Pelouze, who was a Frenchman. But again, it's written in German. But the next paper was written in French, right? On the law of substitutions and the theory of types. And it says, a letter written to Justus Liebig. So Liebig published a letter that was written to him in French on this subject. The next paper, in that letter, there's some funny formulas like Cl2Cl2 plus C4Cl2O2 or this funny thing here. We'll come back to see what that was. But you see, it was written by a guy named S.C.H. Vintler. And then the next paper was another one on the reaction of chlorine with things by Regnault in France, but again written in German. The only thing in French was that letter. Okay, now this is the letter on the substitution law and the theory of types, a letter to Justus Liebig, Paris, 1st March 1840. "Monsieur, I am eager to communicate to you one of the most striking facts of organic chemistry. I have confirmed the substitution theory in an extremely remarkable and completely unexpected manner. Only now can one appreciate the great value of this theory and foresee the immense discoveries it promises to reveal." So he goes through in great detail and describes exactly what condition he used, sometimes light, sometimes heat, the colors, the crystals he got, their shape, and so on. So he started with manganese acetate, which has that formula, and he reacted it with chlorine and was able to substitute the hydrogens in acetate by chlorine, as Dumas had already done. But then he went further. With more vigorous conditions, he was able to replace the O in the manganese oxide. Then he was able to replace the manganese in the manganese oxide. And then he was able to replace the carbon and the oxygen in the chloroacetate. And in fact, now he had stuff that had exactly the same properties as it did before, but it was composed entirely of chlorine. Right? He says, "For all I know, the decolorizing action of chlorine, in the decolorizing action of chlorine, hydrogen is replaced by chlorine, and the cloth, which is now being bleached in England, preserves its type according to the substitution laws. I believe, however, that my atom for atom substitution of carbon by chlorine is my own discovery to replace carbon by chlorine. I hope you will take note of this in your journal and be assured of my sincerest regards, etc. S.C.H. Vintler." And there's a footnote which says, "I've just learned that there's already in the London shops a cloth made from chlorine thread, which is very much sought after and preferred above all others for nightcaps, underwear, and so on." Now, this is Wöhler writing, the guy who makes puns and all sorts of things. He sent this letter to Berzelius, who had been his teacher, as a joke. And then Berzelius said, "Why not send a copy to Liebig instead?" So he sent a copy of this joke letter to Liebig. And to his chagrin, Liebig published it, which didn't amuse Dumas at all. Right? So this was a joke gone wrong. Okay. So all he was doing was making fun of Dumas, obviously. Okay. So there was a lot of hard feeling between that, even though Wöhler tried to make light of it. In 1849, Kolbe in Germany prepared a free methyl radical, the actual element, right, by electrolysis. So he electrolyzed acetic acid and got methyl radical, CH3, which was a great support for the idea that you could have these elements, the radicals. Okay, except a decade later, the molecular weight of his methyl was determined, and it was shown he had the dimer, dimethyl or ethane. Okay. So much for that. And now, curiously, the key reactions of both theories, both the radical theory and the type theory, involved reactions that involved free radicals. So, in fact, there were free radicals involved in all these reactions, but not as elements, as transient intermediates. For example, in the oxidation of the oil of bitter almonds to give benzoic acid, it turns out there's this free radical as an intermediate. We'll talk about that later. Okay, or in the one with chlorine, this where you pull off one hydrogen first and then replace it by chlorine. That's that chain reaction we talked about, right? Or in this one, you take an electron away from here And now you've got an odd electron here. And now you do those single electron shifts, and you in fact get the methyl radical as an intermediate, but it's very reactive, SOMO with SOMO, as we discussed before, so two of them get together to form ethane. So all these things, the fundamental reactions of both theories do in fact involve free radicals, but not as elements, as transient intermediates that don't last very long, because they're so reactive. Because we already saw that if you have two SOMOs, it's always downhill to make a bond between them. Okay, so here's what we've been studying, Dumas, Liebig, and Wöhler, about benzoyl radical substitution theory, type theory, and the dualistic theory. And now we go on to the real payoff, which is valence and the theory of benzene. And this involves the next generation of people, August Kekulé, who's out on the board outside, but also Archibald Scott Cooper from Scotland, who isn't on the wall outside. And I'll tell you just a little bit about him. So here's Archibald Scott Cooper, 1831 to 92, so he lived 61 years. He was the son of a guy who ran a weaving factory in Kirkintilloch near Glasgow. And he was sort of a dilettante. He went to university and studied all sorts of different things, classics, metaphysics, logic, moral philosophy, went to a lot of concerts. He would go for some terms to Berlin, back to Edinburgh, and so on. He was a well-to-do guy, right? But in 1855, in Berlin, he became very fascinated by chemistry and began to study it. And in 1856, he went to Paris. So he went from the German to the French school, worked with Wurtz and worked on salicylic acid, which you yourselves have worked on. And in 1858, when in Paris, he got fired and sent home. And in 1859 to 1892, he did nothing. He was a mental invalid. He had a psychological breakdown after this. So everything he did before 1858. But it was really important. Here's his hometown, Kirkintilloch, in Scotland, near Glasgow. And above the door of this house, there's a marble plaque that says it marks the birthplace of Archibald Scott Cooper, whose brilliant pioneering contributions to chemical theory have won for him international renown, and whose genius, stifled by an early illness, was denied the opportunity of consummation. And here's where he got sunstroke that put him out for good. And here's where the house his mother built, his father had died to nurse him for his last 33 years. She survived him. And this is the really, really important paper on a new chemical theory by Archibald Scott Cooper, Esquire. And we'll go on with this next time to see what he did.